Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
This year, I plan to spend the summer solstice on the peak of Carn Tuil, joining the annual procession of walkers to the summit, where a group sets up camp overnight and watches the sun rise over the McGillicuddy Reeks. I hope for a clear morning where, gloved and booted, sipping a coffee from a flask and squeezing my toes to stay warm, I'll see the mystic lines of light move across the curving horseshoe of mountains and catch the jagged limestone tip of the Hag's Tooth, while below me, the lakes in Cwm Cali, a U-shaped valley from the Ice Age, remain in cool shadow. Climbing Carn Tuil is no easy feat. I've made several attempts at it, not always reaching the summit, and only once has my view from the top been free of cloud. Then I saw the panoramic landscape of County Kerry, the stretches of both the Dingle and Evora peninsulas, and the flat green plains to the north, out towards Tralee. My first attempt to climb Carn Tuil began from the south of the mountain range, from the Bridagh Valley. I used to spend my free days hiking in Wicklow, often climbing the 925 metres of Lugnaquilla. So I thought I'd manage Carn Tuil's extra 113 metres easily enough. On this occasion, some hours in, we reached the clouds, and as we stepped into the haze, it was like vanishing into a different, dangerous world. Fog raced across our narrow ridge, dragging our bodies to the leftmost edge. I could feel my knees grow weak, and I wanted to sit, but I was urged by the others to keep moving, as cold can set in fast. As the weather worsened, we had no option but to turn back. Next time, it was a cold, bright morning in January, with blue skies promising panoramic views. On this occasion, we took the most popular route from the north, parking in Cronin's Yard, and taking the 3 kilometre walk to Cwm Cali, passing Loch Gurra and Loch Cali, and up the swift, steep climb that is known as the Devil's Ladder. Now, the Devil's Ladder is more challenging than a simple hike on a slope. It's a physical climb up a shale-filled gully formed by a small stream. However, as we ascended, we were protected from the wind by the horseshoe ring of mountains, so we felt relatively safe. When we reached the top of the gully, we emerged onto an exposed wide ridge that joined Knocknatee rising to the left and Carn Tuil to the right. Here was a frighteningly alien world where a snowstorm raged. With limited visibility, we tried to follow the trail of stone mounds to the summit, while being pushed back by wild gusts, the snow stinging our faces. 100 metres up, we met a walking guide with a small group who were descending, and he warned us to go no further. It was on my third attempt, following the Devil's Ladder route again, that I made it to the summit. This time, on the wide flat ridge, it was foggy, but the air was still. There were no views to be had, but it was relatively safe to follow the stone piles marking the route to the peak, until sometime later the shadow of the iconic steel cross appeared through the haze. My pace increased, the sight of the cross telling me my journey's end was near, and I was amazed at its scale as we drew closer. At the summit, my husband took a picture of me standing in front of the cross in the fog, red-cheeked, arms raised in victory, before we took out our flattened sandwiches for a picnic in the small summit shelter and began to plan our descent. The last time we attempted the climb, a lucky break in the clouds meant I finally got to witness the panoramic view of Kerry from the top of Carn Tuil. I beheld the whole of the county, its vast, wild, sublime beauty, and it made me think of the biblical tale of Christ standing on the tallest mountain and viewing the kingdoms of the world. It's curious how the sublime does that, draws out something forgotten within us, something bigger, poetic even. And witnessing this magnificent panorama was certainly all the sweeter for the many efforts it took to experience it. Thank you.
Jimmy Costigan, the Hackney man, carried all of my siblings in turn to Care Railway Station in his big black Zephyr. This was the first leg of their emigrant journey to London in the 60s. Jimmy, grocer, undertaker and hackney man, was a central figure in the pageantry of loss that blighted my childhood as I watched my sister and three brothers leave, while I, the youngest, stayed at home. They boarded the train bound for Rosslare at Care Station, travelled on the mail boat from Rosslare to Fishguard, where in the raw dawn hours they'd wait in a freezing lean-to for the train to Paddington Station, a punishing and interminable journey. My aunts, women who had also emigrated as children a few decades previously, would meet them. They'd sleep on haphazard beds on the floors of the aunts' council flats until work was secured in the kitchens of the London hotels, where the aunts themselves chopped and peeled, scrubbed and scoured. Jimmy, the hackney man, was kindly in his concern for his young emigrating passengers. The father of 11 children himself, he knew the fear and loneliness prompting the hot tears shed into makeshift handkerchiefs. He encouraged those youngsters, still children, with stories of all that awaited them in Blighty. Wasn't the half a care over there? They'd be meeting up with the lads from home in no time. They'd earn good money and be back like toffs at Christmas. His hand on the shoulder was warm and avuncular as he wished them Godspeed and good luck, child. Jimmy would discreetly return to his car when the mournful echoing rumble and the dipped signal indicated the imminent arrival of the train. We'd busy ourselves with suitcases. Hasty shorthand instructions were uttered to write when you get there and mind your money. We'd watch, heavy with familiar grief, until the train turned the corner and all the fluttering hankies waved from the windows were out of view. We'd limp back to Jimmy's car in lonely silence. "They'll be grand," he'd console my mother. "You'll have a letter next week." While Jimmy, the hackney man, was synonymous with these lonely journeys to the railway station, he brought us on joyful trips too. We hired him every summer to drive us to visit my mother's larger-than-life brother, Pat Coughlin, and his brandy-drinking wife, Molly, in Kilmacthomas, County Waterford. Here Jimmy was introduced as the man that drives them. Pat and Molly were gas characters who relished our visit. The pig's head and cabbage would simmer in the pots. Jimmy would eat with us until the meat collapsed to bone and gristle. Then he'd take a discreet walk to give us time to discuss family business. Not that there was much business to discuss with Pat, whose cheery bellow assured us that despite whatever ailed us, hadn't we America at home. The trip always involved an hour or two in the Bally Inn, where the publican, the redoubtable Lena Walsh, held court. She was an exotic figure with big dramatic brown eyes and a wire-haired terrier called Whacker. He drank his water from an ashtray on which two dogs, one black, one white, advertised Buchanan's Scotch whisky. As Whacker lapped the water, Lena sang along with Patsy Cline on the jukebox and brought a cigarette in a sleek cigarette holder to her painted lips. After each annual visit, Jimmy would always comment that there were no flies on Lena. An astute businessman himself, he admired the acumen and grit of a single woman who ran a pub and, in my mother's summary, wouldn't call the Queen her aunt. As a child, I was all ears when Jimmy's daughter Eileen, who was in my class in school, regaled us with stories about the characters who hired Jimmy to ferry them there and yon. There was a standing arrangement every Saturday evening to drive Johnny Cahill the Hermit to the cinema in Clonmel. Johnny, who lived in a hovel with neither water nor electricity and only ate bars of fruit and nut, had a surprising and consuming interest in the pictures. He'd hire Jimmy on a weekly basis to drive him to watch the latest exploits of John Wayne or Gregory Peck. Jimmy, along with the cinema staff, understood the importance of this fantasy life to a lonely rural bachelor. The usherette would never train the long, narrow beam of her torch on him as he'd roar encouragement at the screen, travelling as he did in his imagination north to Alaska with John Wayne. On the journey home from the cinema, they'd pick up another character from the pub, one Ted Norris, who, before he'd occupy the back seat, would whack the roof of the Zephyr with his ash plant as if he was striking the rump of a horse, hastening the steed to gallop the miles. Jimmy brought us on many trips, heartbreaking ones and exciting ones. It's a consolation to me that his son Wally has continued the undertaking business in care. I like to think that Jimmy's son will accompany me part of the way on my own final journey.
Way up north,
north to Alaska.
Way up north,
north to Alaska.
North to Alaska. Go north for us, your son. North to Alaska, go north to Russia's own. Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92 with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy too.
The word stranger is an odd one. It suggests so many things. Uncertainty, threat even. Or on a more positive note, possibility, adventure, a new way of hearing things, a new way of seeing things, the potential for friendship. But it also raises the possibility that our friends and family can be strangers to us, that we can be strangers to ourselves. The Argentinian writer Borges suggested that we each live three lives, a public life, a private life, and a secret life. And what life is more secret than the life of dreams? Some time ago, I had a dream that I was walking through the woods at Mullacreelin, my favourite place to walk. In the dream, I was who I am, a man in my 70s, still capable of walking at a good pace, and still enjoying the beauty of the summer evening that illuminated that dream. The place was quiet, the laughing children and their parents long gone. It was that time of year when the bluebells were just beginning to fade, but still held a blueness that sat like a mist over the floor of the forest. And then I saw coming towards me a young man of 21 or 22. He was bearded, wearing jeans and a shirt, striding quickly between the trees, his head held high. A slight, slim, long-haired young man, walking with all the made-up confidence that is the best inexperience can offer. And I stopped, dumbfounded by who and what I was seeing. At the young man's heels was a dog, a bobtail, its coat blowing in the warm summer breeze, its steps in time with the man's, as determined as he was to get wherever they were bound. But the thing that shocked me, even in the wildness of the dream world, was the fact that the young man was me. His clothes were familiar to me, the blue denim shirt, sleeves rolled up, the bell-bottomed jeans and worn runners. I recognised the wild beard, the long flowing hair, the determined step. And I recognised the dog. I knew his name, Mr. Bojangles. Man and dog approached, weaving between the trees. I stood my ground and nodded as the pair passed. But there was no recognition from either of them, not even a sign that they could see me. The soft evening breeze washed me in a sadness that seeped beyond the dream. A realization came that I knew I would carry beyond this sleeping state. A realization that I was an outsider to myself, and that the young man in his 1970s life was a stranger to the older me. We had lost contact with each other, and so many of the ideas and aspirations and hopes of that time were gone. buried with the remains of that dog at his master's side. The young man was a shadow from my past, a soul with aspirations of his own, aspirations that would and wouldn't reach fruition. But for now, in that dream, he had no concern for and no awareness of the man he would become. And I? What was I? I have no answer to that question.
My life, I'm a lot like you were. Oh man, look at my life.
On the 22nd of June 1930, 14-year-old Gerald Lakin sent a postcard from Eton College to his family's parlour maid in Ireland. "Please send me a pair of long flannel trousers," he wrote. Over 90 years later, I'm holding the card in my hand. The handwriting is the elegant cursive of the time, and the underlining of the words long and flannel gives an air of urgency to the message. The long trousers were to be sent care of his housemaster, J.C. Batterwick, Esquire, as soon as possible, and I can only surmise that cricket season was approaching, or that the boy was hoping to go boating and needed to appear in attire befitting a young gentleman. I found the postcard recently in a tin box at the back of my mother's wardrobe. The box belonged to my late grandmother, Annie Keating, and as well as Gerald Lakin's postcard, there were yellowed and crumbling newspaper clippings, postcards arranging barn dances, some holy pictures, and a photo of Granny with 1925 Hortown House scribbled on the back. Annie was born into a family of 16 in 1906. She left school at the age of 12, and through her teens, she worked in the kitchens of various farmhouses and big houses. When she was 19, she landed her dream job as house parlour maid in Hortown House, County Wexford. The photo in the box shows her on the steps of the big house, smiling like a film star, her curls cropped into the fashionable bobbed style of the time. Hortown House was owned by the Lakin family. Major Michael Lakin, known as Toby, was a veteran of the Boer War and World War I. His wife Kathleen was a Fitzgerald from the family who owned Johnstown Castle. My grandmother loved her time in Hortown. She idolised Kathleen Lakin and was very fond of the Major, who was exceptionally generous to his staff. For her 21st birthday, the Major presented Annie with a pet lamb. "You rear it and I'll sell it for you," he told her. The Lakins had two little boys, always referred to as Master Gerald and Master Vic, when Granny told us about them in her old age. "They were like chalk and cheese," she said. "Master Gerald was outgoing and friendly, while Master Vic was quiet and shy." The good times at Hortown House came to an end on the 21st of February 1930, when Kathleen Lakin was thrown from her horse at the hunt. That afternoon, Annie, anticipating the return of the hunt, had heated the water for her mistress's bath, laid out her towels and talcum powder, and pressed the blue evening dress that Mrs. Lakin would wear for dinner that evening. She listened for the sound of hooves on the avenue, which would be the signal for her to carry out cups of soup to the hunters, but instead she heard a motor car draw up. The knocker fell ominously on the front door. Moments later, there was a cry of distress. The Major had just been informed that his wife had been seriously injured. By evening, the household was plunged into despair. News was relayed that the mistress was not expected to live. Next day, the Major arranged for the maids to be brought to Wexford Hospital to see Mrs. Lakin for the last time. One by one, the women approached the heavily bandaged figure in the bed. Remembering how she herself might have died from pleurisy the previous winter, only that the Lakins had paid for a private nurse to look after her, Annie took Mrs. Lakin's hand, leaned down, and whispered something tender to her. She never told me what her words to her mistress were, but she was rewarded with a gentle smile as the dying woman squeezed her hand. In keeping with the tradition of the time, Kathleen's sons, Victor and Gerald, he of the flannel trousers, were not informed of their mother's death until a full week later, when their father travelled to their boarding school in England to break the news and bring them home. Annie was in the kitchen when the major's car arrived back. The front door was flung open, and the two distraught boys burst into the hall. 50 years later, Granny still wept as she remembered the cries of "Mama, Mama," echoing through the house as the heartbroken children raced up the stairs to their mother's room. Within a short time, the boys returned to Eton, and life in Hortown continued without the beloved mistress of the house. The major threw himself into memorialising his late wife, and in less than 2 years, a new maternity wing bearing her name opened at Wexford Hospital. Like their father and uncle before them, Gerald and Victor Lakin's destiny lay in the military. They both served in North Africa with the 16th 5th Lancers in World War II. Victor was badly wounded but survived the war. Gerald died in battle in Tunisia, and he was buried there in February 1943. Now I'm thinking of the 14-year-old boy with less than half his life left before him, grief-stricken and lonely on a long midsummer evening, as he sat in the study hall writing a postcard to his late mother's maid, signing off with a cheery sounding, "Hoping you and everyone are very well," before addressing it to Miss Annie Keating, Hortown House, County Wexford, Ireland, in ink that has faded little in over 90 years.
There's a side street in Dublin City that always makes me pause when I pass by it. Yet despite my long fascination with the location, I only ever stand on its threshold. Then I look, for a moment or a minute, at the object of my curiosity. 7 Henrietta Place, a 200-year-old former warehouse. To me it holds a beguiling power. The two-story stone building juts out on the curve of the street at an odd angle, yet it also looks like it's trying to hide by leaning into the shadows. If you ignore the signage dotted around its exterior, to look at it is to feel transported back to the 19th century, to a Dublin of horses on cobbled streets, narrow laneways, and ships loaded with exotic bounty landing at the docks. I moved to Dublin from Cork in the late noughties, and have only ever known 7 Henrietta Place as an empty building. The chief reason for my interest in it, and slight wariness of it too, was the square sign on the building's side, featuring a picture of a mustachioed man in a hat and the word Transylvania. What an evocative sign. It brought me images from Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, of tall castles shrouded in clouds, fanged men eager for me to meet my demise. The man pictured on the sign was Vlad the Impaler, said to have inspired Stoker's blood-sucking monster. The building's shabby appearance and a second, larger sign in fading neon below boarded-up windows only added to the spooky ambiance. But the Transylvania that made its home in this building was nothing dangerous. The sign simply advertised a long-closed Romanian restaurant. For years, I pictured gloomy nights there, with customers eating hearty soup by candlelight, pale-faced waiters in starched white shirts, a misty history that I would never be privy to. Recently, I walked past Henrietta Place and did a double take. Gone was the larger neon Transylvania sign from the front of the building. It was replaced with something Dracula would balk at, a sign in bright primary colours. The darkness hovering over that side of the street had even seemed to dissipate. I felt a pinch of sadness about the sign disappearing and posted a photograph of it on Instagram, knowing that some of my Dublin friends would likely miss the old neon glory too. That they did, and several directed me to an article in the Dublin Inquirer about the history of the stone building. It transpired that Transylvania restaurant was opened just before the turn of the millennium by a Romanian man named Petre Tănase. He told the publication he arrived in Ireland to seek asylum in the late 1990s. He wanted the restaurant to show off food from the country he loved and give a good name to Romanian people like him who were making their home in Ireland. But though Tănase's restaurant thrived and got good reviews, he told the media that Ireland wasn't always a welcome home for newcomers at that time. During the 3 or 4 years he ran the restaurant, some people threw stones in the door. Others shouted at him to go home. The gap in time between the heyday of Transylvania Restaurant and today can feel so large, as if the Dublin of the early 2000s was an entirely different city. In some ways it was. The restaurant opened at the height of the Celtic Tiger, before the country was plunged into a recession. Yet in many ways, Dublin is the same as back then. It's still a city where people arrive to seek safety and opportunities, where eager business owners attempt to put their mark on the capital. It's a place with a constantly weaving flow of newcomers and old-timers. When I walk through the city, as I do almost daily, I see a busy, diverse place that's still got plenty of beauty in it. The building that housed the old Transylvania restaurant is earmarked for migrant social inclusion services. I suppose this speaks to the current challenges faced by the city and its ongoing attempts to remedy them. There's a relief in seeing it used for this purpose when empty buildings are so common in the capital that they melt into the background. Living in Dublin means contending with the city's ghosts. Since moving here, I've been untangling what the streets have to tell me about themselves. I look for signs, I guess at histories. I ask what the past can teach me about how we live now. I imagine that soon the remaining Transylvania restaurant sign will be removed, just like its neon sibling. But I hope it stays, so it can remain a breadcrumb to follow. A story about Dublin's past, present and future, still waiting to be unravelled by another curious stranger.
We were bundled into the back of my father's old battered van, my 8-year-old friend Michael and me, off to stock up on a fresh supply of vegetables from my father's little corner shop in town. He was waiting for us outside the school gates when the bell rang. He beeped the horn, and as if it was all pre-arranged, the door was flung open, and then, pell-mell, in we both climbed. And soon we were off, trundling through streets we already knew, and then streets we vaguely recognised, followed by streets that were strange and alluring to us, and finally out into, well, for two small town lads like us at any rate, the rough and wild countryside. My next clear memory is of Michael and me running around a green field, like two savages on a spree, while my father pow-wowed with the local farmer. And I recall seeing a hare that day, running and bounding and darting. Michael insists that we didn't see the hare that day, that it was a different time. But I know for a fact that it was that day, because right after the hare vanished into the long grass, my father's voice called out to us to get off the man's cabbage. Was there a girl? The farmer's freckled-faced daughter, perhaps? Laughing at her antics, no? Maybe not. The next I know, we are back in the van again and we are sitting on a bed of cabbage and tossing a burst ball about as we bounce and roughly bound homeward. And that's when we happened on the young man and what I took to be his grandmother walking towards town. She had her arm draped affectionately around his slumped shoulder. She raised her hand and my father pulled over and there was a short conversation between them. "You're very good to stop," she began in her country accent. "Ah, no, not at all," my father assured her in a smoky voice. She looked into my father's face and through the rear-view mirror I saw him from her perspective. His hooded, honest eyes and his slightly pockmarked face and the makings of a cauliflower ear from his boxing days and his two dislocated thumbs. And I could see that she instantly and instinctively trusted him. "I'll tell you what it is now," she went on. And she leaned in and told my father the whole sorry saga. After that, the young man, 15 or 16 at most, with the makings of a little downy moustache, he climbed into the front seat beside my father while his suitcase, a fairly battered affair, was tossed into the back. He had a boil on the back of his neck and his face was pasty and pimply, and when he said goodbye to his grandmother, his voice was cracked and broken. I couldn't help but notice that he could not bring himself to look around at her when we pulled away. I caught a glimpse of the old lady, sad and silvery now in the failing light, as she stood there waving goodbye to nobody. It was dark when we arrived back in town. My father parked a van on the quayside, right opposite a small down-at-heel pub-cum-boarding house called the Black Horse Inn. And then he and the young man, who looked like a fish out of water, got out and crossed the street together. Music sprang from the bar when they opened the door, and then things were muffled again, and to my way of thinking anyway, a little sinister. The neon sign above the door, as if it was in on the joke, winked at us. A woman came out and lit a cigarette, and then she stood like she was waiting for someone, one arm akimbo as she puffed. Whoever it was she was waiting for didn't materialise, and she eventually, sparks flying, left in a bit of a huff. Meanwhile, Michael and I fell silent. He concentrated on the smoking woman and on the fellow who came out looking for her after she fled. I, on the other hand, projected myself inside the bar where my father was busy booking a room for the young man for the night. Yeah, the young man was going to London, hence the suitcase. My father had picked this particular boarding house because it was close to the railway station, so that in the morning all the boy had to do was to cross the street and catch the early morning train to the harbour. From there he would board a mail boat for Fishguard, followed by another train down to Paddington, which I knew was situated in the very heart of London town. I knew this because my two uncles were already over there. They would come home together and sit in our kitchen drinking tea, one of them from a saucer, and they'd regale us with fascinating, hair-raising stories of the city. And once one of them gave Michael and me a half-crown between us to spend. And what about the young man? I pictured him arriving in Paddington, and like a shipwrecked castaway, he'd linger where he landed. He'd probably get a job as a bellboy in some swanky hotel, and he'd slowly but surely work his way up through the ranks until he'd end, he'd become the big-hatted doorman on the door. He'd come home once or twice a year with a slight English twang, and eventually, when his grandmother was gone, in all likelihood, he'd probably... I was jolted from my reverie when my father came back out of the pub alone. He climbed into the driving seat, and smelling a porter, he drove off without a word of explanation. I wasn't to know it then, but not long after that fateful night, my father would lose his corner shop and he too would have to emigrate. For the next 7 years, he'd work in a factory in a new town just north of London called Stevenage. He'd come home, like my uncles before him, for a week at Christmas time and a fortnight every summer. In the meantime, my mother, my sisters and I would learn to live without him. And yes, I'm sorry to say, we'd also learn to take his sacrifice for granted. We'd grow accustomed to a gentle life without a father figure, so that by the time he came home for good again, the damage was well and truly done, and the gulf that already existed between us had deepened and widened, almost beyond human repair. The only consolation I have is I'm fairly sure I caught a defining glimpse of him in the rear-view mirror in the van all those years ago. His ordinary silent strength, and the sadness of his smile, and the hurt in his eyes. Was he aware then of the misery that lay ahead, I wonder? And then there's his voice, calling out to Michael and me as we ran around the green field. And no, his voice is not cross. It's warm and kind, and it's filled with a strange, tender admiration for our boyish, mischievous deeds. Get off the man's cabbage!
On this morning's programme, we heard Climbing Carn Tuathail by Jamie O'Connell, The Hackney Man by Margaret Galvin, Strange Meeting by John McKenna, Postcard to Annie by A.M. Cousins, Dinner at Transylvania was by Aoife Barry, and Michael and Me by Billy Roach. The music was ID na Gréine by Steve Cooney, North to Alaska by Johnny Horton, Old Man by Neil Young, Chopin's Prelude in E Minor, played by Conor Linehan, and Bartók's Romanian Folk Dance No. 3, played by Daniel Hope with the Zirkshire Chamber Orchestra. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And on sound was Liam Mullen. You can listen back on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.